and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is spending more than $1 billion in Puerto Rico to repair homes damaged by Hurricane Maria. But much of that money is going to contractors charging steep markups and overhead. The New York Times reports that some repairs are indeed being made, but at an astronomical cost. Next, seven men were found guilty yesterday of the murder of Honduran indigenous environmental activist Berta Cáceres, who was shot and killed on March 2, 2016, 2 days before her 45th birthday. Cáceres had waged a long battle to stop construction of an internationally financed hydroelectric dam on the Gualcarque River, which the Lenca people consider sacred. The judge found that the murder was ordered by the construction company's executives. Then, Manor Care was a highly respected nursing home and retirement community company based in Silver Spring, Maryland. 5 years ago, it was taken over by the Carlyle Group, one of the largest private equity firms in the world. Under Carlyle's ownership, however, the company went bankrupt, and serious cases of elder abuse are now coming to light. And then the political news website Politico this week published an article about the foreign press and their apparent love affair with Donald Trump. The thrust of the article was that the foreign press doesn't criticize the president because fawning coverage is a way for countries to ingratiate themselves with him. But the article focuses on, of course, the Russians. It makes no mention of the Israeli press or news outlets in most Arab countries. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is spending more than $1 billion in Puerto Rico to repair homes damaged by Hurricane Maria. But much of that money is going to contractors charging steep markups and overhead. The New York Times reports that some repairs are indeed being made, but only at an astronomical cost. We're joined from Kalamazoo, Michigan, by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez, Department Chair and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Dr. Garriga-Lopez, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about the pace of repairs in Puerto Rico. Why has this taken so long, and why is this gouging taking place?
So repairs in Puerto Rico have been very slow, and as we are seeing now coming out, first in this New York Times report and in subsequent stories, there's been a significant overhead costs that have been added on to those repair costs. And there's a variety of factors that are going into that. But I think one big one is that we see the majority of contracts being given to stateside companies, continental companies. And so what that means is that they have to transport not only the people who are going to do the labor, which usually actually is a subcontractor for those companies, but also supplies, equipment, in some cases, even things like trucks and cars that they will need to carry out that those repairs. And so on the one hand, we have this extremely expensive approach that favors U.S.-based companies, right, continental-based companies. And at the same time, those companies in the U.S. themselves don't really have the capacity or the capability to carry out those repairs. And so they are hiring and subcontracting other companies, smaller companies, which themselves have to assume the high cost of transporting their labor and their parts over to Puerto Rico, but also are confronting the reality in Puerto Rico of the extremely high cost of consumer goods and the really high tax burden that people in Puerto Rico pay. There is the reality of the shipping costs that are extremely high in Puerto Rico due to the Jones Act and the shipping regulations that are placed on Puerto Rico. And then there's also a 12% consumer's tax that people in Puerto Rico pay on almost every consumer goods that I think some people from the U.S. Mainland are surprised to encounter. But this does not, even those sort of real costs of doing this repair work does not explain or do not explain the extremely high markup that we are seeing. And if you read through the articles that have been published, you'll see quickly that even the subcontractors in the U.S. are complaining because the people higher up on the chain are keeping, you know, sometimes up to 60% of the funding for overhead and profit. And so it's basically a giant scam.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, that's what it is. And the people that are suffering the effects of that scam are the people in Puerto Rico who are still living under blue FEMA tarps, right? And so I think one thing that is really important to understand is that although a lot of the news items seem to frame it as though there's a corruption issue in Puerto Rico specifically, and there may, in fact, I would say probably is some amount of corruption taking place in Puerto Rico, meaning that there's people in Puerto Rico who are not doing any work who are benefiting from some of those overhead and profit monies themselves, the majority of the issue is actually the ongoing preferencing of U.S. mainland companies by FEMA, which has resulted over and over and over since Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Irma affected Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, in inefficient, highly problematic, highly suspect contracts, starting with the Whitefish Company and continuing, which had to be canceled, right, that contract, and continuing with the company that was contracted in the southern United States to provide tarps, which never arrived in Puerto Rico, the companies that were hired in Florida and Georgia to provide meals that never arrived in Puerto Rico, and so on and so forth. So we're seeing more of the same, but I think it's very problematic to frame it as an issue of corruption in Puerto Rico, because what we have is a systematic issue with FEMA wanting to give money to U.S.-based companies because they don't trust builders and companies in Puerto Rico. So they say, oh, no, we have to make sure that we have responsible people doing this, right? And the framing is always of Puerto Ricans as irresponsible. And so, you know, they give the money to the U.S. companies, but the U.S. companies don't have any idea, have no idea what it means to do business in Puerto Rico.
We're joined from Michigan by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez, Department Chair and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Doctor, you, or professor, I should say, you mentioned this New York Times article. I think this is a very important piece. There's one paragraph in particular. It says, homeowners, comma, who were approved for up to $20,000 each in aid, so that means everybody's approved for up to $20,000, in nearly every case received less than half of what they were approved for, while layers of contractors and middlemen took the rest, a review of hundreds of invoices and contracts associated with the program shows. They begin this article by talking about sort of a typical family. They had 4 feet of cabinets that needed to be replaced and some sealant around the roof and smoke detectors installed with Velcro. The owner of the house says, I looked around and said, wait a minute, that treatment costs $100 and I can buy those cabinets for $500. I know, I worked in construction. Let's say they did $2,000 worth of work because prices are high now and you have to pay for labor, but $5,000? So it was $500 worth of work. Maybe $2,000 worth of work, let's say, who knows? And they charge $5,000. Now, this article goes on to say that this is actually not abnormal in a disaster area because prices are so inflated after a disaster. I agree with you that corruption probably plays a role at some level. But is this really normal?
Well, that's the thing about the so-called free market.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
The free market, and, you know, Naomi Klein wrote the book, The Shock Doctrine, for instance.
Right.
Which, you know, exploded the myth that the free market is actually free because capitalism and contractors and profiteers take advantage of any crisis, whether it was September 11th or crisis that are, quote, man-made, like the invasion of Iraq, for instance, a big crisis for the people in Iraq. Each and every time, there's a group of profiteers, like vultures, ready to swoop in and say, yeah, we'll provide these services at these inflated price-gouging costs. It's almost the fundamental nature of the so-called free market, which, again, is not a free market. Go ahead.
Yes, this has been a feeding frenzy in Puerto Rico, and it's been a feeding frenzy for U.S. companies looking to make high, high profits off of a terrible situation in Puerto Rico. And I think you said it correctly, and I find it interesting that you mention Iraq, because what we have seen since Maria has been the Baghdadization of San Juan. And these contractors are themselves connected in many ways to the military and to private security corporations. And they're used to going into situations of chaos and crisis and finding ways of making a profit. That's what they do. That's how these companies make their money. And I think that that is a very important piece of this picture. And in fact, we are seeing exactly the processes of disaster capitalism and accumulation through dispossession that are part and parcel of the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein has described, as well as other people. And I think that we're going to continue to see this for as long as FEMA funds are available. There's going to be this kind of vulture economy taking place in Puerto Rico. And I think it's important to note that I have questions about the New York Times article, because I know that not everybody that was approved for repair funds by FEMA was approved for $20,000. In fact, I think that person that you talked about, that family, was only approved for $5,000. And I personally know of people who were only approved for things like $1,800 or $3,000 to repair damages to their homes. So only a very few are getting that $20,000. And I think the other number that we need to keep in mind is that as of a couple of months ago, when the last reporting came out through the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico, which has been doing an amazing job of holding the government accountable, only about 5 to 10% of claims that people have made for housing repairs have actually been approved. So we're talking about a very, very, very small minority of people who are actually being approved for those repairs. And when the repairs are done, they are shoddy, they are insufficient, and they still leave people in unsafe housing conditions.
Yeah, and in fact, it's no better than it was immediately after the hurricane, except maybe there's food. I apologize that we're out of time, though. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Michigan by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez, Department Chair and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Kalamazoo College. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Seven men were found guilty yesterday of the murder of Honduran indigenous environmental activist Berta Cáceres, who was shot and killed on March 2, 2016, just 2 days before her 45th birthday. Cáceres had waged a long battle to stop construction of an internationally financed hydroelectric dam on the Gualcarque River, which the Lenca people consider sacred. The judge found that the murder was ordered by the construction company's executives. We're joined from Honduras by Jackie McVicker. She's a member of the Atlantic Region Solidarity Network, working in solidarity with people struggling for social justice and environmental protection in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Atlantic Canada, and a former co-coordinator of the Maritimes Guatemala Breaking the Silence Solidarity Network. Welcome back, Jackie.
Hi, thanks.
Jackie, this was a dramatic development yesterday. Can you tell us what this means, not just in the region, but really for the rest of North America?
So yesterday, the verdict in the first trial against eight men accused of Berta's murder, the sentence came down. Seven of the men were convicted of murder. Four of them were convicted of the attempted murder of Gustavo Castro, the environmentalist from Mexico who was with Berta, her friend, who was with her the night that she was killed. This sentence really is just the beginning of what is a very long struggle for justice for Berta. As the court said yesterday, DESA, the hydroelectric company building the dam on the Gualcarque River, knew through its executives were part of the planning and the itself. And they clearly said that named people during the course of the trial that were involved, including members of the Atala Zabla family who run DESA. They also convicted yesterday. Part of the people that were convicted were DESA employees, but also a high-ranking senior intelligence officer with the Honduran military, which they repeated over and over again, had the responsibility as an armed, as someone in the armed forces to have reported the planning of a murder. And instead of reporting that, and he was actively participating in the execution of Berta Cáceres. This, though, is just the beginning, I think, because it just shows the corruption. This this trial, what has basically shown is the impunity that exists in terms of how licenses for extractive projects like mining and hydroelectric projects in not only in Honduras, but the whole region, how that happens, the corruption within the state, how state officials were bought off, and how they actively participated in different, including in trying to immediately after Berta's murder in the cover-up. And so I think that this verdict is important. It's an important step forward, but by no means does this mean that there's been justice for Berta, but definitely showing the criminal structures that are behind extractive companies operating in the region. I think it's been a very strong message to companies and the state.
Let me ask you about that then. So the company, besides these individuals, the company itself has been implicated in this murder. So what does this mean for the company? Besides the individuals who were arrested and convicted the other day, there has to be some sort of fallout for the company itself, no?
Well, in theory, there should be, absolutely. I mean, at the same time, you know, the license for the development of this dam is still exists. A lot of the international funding has been cut, but not all of the international funding has been cut of this particular project. So, I mean, ideally, they need to cancel the license for this project, and they need to look at the criminal structure. I mean, it was the criminal structure that killed Berta, that systematically was persecuting of Copin, the organization that Berta helped found, were also killed, were also criminalized. And that was shown that the desk executives didn't only know about it, they were part planning it.
Right. And so, is this dam built? Did Berta's death stop it? What's the latest status?
Yeah, it's not. It hasn't been built. It hasn't been built. But the license is still active. It's a license that they have, I think, for 30 years. So I mean, at some point they could get funding again. And so it has not yet been built. This week at the UN, this government of Honduras is at the business and human rights meeting talking about how all of the projects that they support, and including hydroelectric projects, meet sustainable development goals and are promoting projects like the Aguazarca Dam project internationally. So they're actively looking for financing for projects like this, saying that this is green energy, that this is sustainable energy. So I think that discourse also has to be questioned very critically.
Jackie McVicker, tell me also about the justice system in Honduras. These seven men have been convicted of murder. Realistically, what happens to them now?
Well, they won't be sentenced until January. So they'll have a hearing where they're sentenced. I think it's also important to say, in terms of, I'll get to the specific question that you asked, but the context of all this is, you know, the brother of the president of Honduras has just been arrested in the United States, has been identified as a major drug trafficker who organized in the area. We just passed the 1 year since the fraudulent elections in Honduras. The levels of impunity that are going up all the time, the fact that there was almost 40 people killed during the post-electoral violence period, and almost none of those cases have been investigated, much less are people being prosecuted. And so this case is one tiny example, but it's also people like Berta's family are also saying, we don't want the government of Honduras to start saying, oh, well, there's justice for Berta, so you can keep investing in Honduras. This is just one tiny, tiny piece of a larger corrupt justice system. The men who were convicted yesterday will probably face sentences between 30 years to life in jail.
Do you see that realistically happening?
This case, honestly, this trial, this entire legal process from the very beginning has been filled with irregularities.
Yeah.
This is what the family's been denouncing from the beginning. Even in the trial itself, the private prosecutors, so the attorneys representing the family who should be working with state prosecutors in this case, were thrown out. So they weren't even at the table. There was a lot of irregularities. Definitely this is a decision that will be appealed without a doubt. And there will be lots of basis for those appeals.
Tell me also what public opinion is like now in the aftermath of this verdict. What are the Honduran people saying about this?
Yeah, well, it only happened last night at like 6:30. But in general, I mean, it's getting coverage in even, you know, the kind of more conservative newspapers. Everybody in Honduras knows about Berta's case. There was a lot of secrecy around her trial. That was another problem because the state wouldn't allow for it to be transmitted. It wouldn't allow it to be transmitted like through a live feed. So a lot of people didn't know what was happening in the trial. But I think people are skeptical because they're also realistic and know. I mean, there is no support for the Juan Orlando Hernández government. Broad support. And I think there's a lot of people that are very skeptical about what the actual outcome is going to be. But I mean, at the same time, people from Rio Blanco, the community affected by the hydroelectric project who were there yesterday, were happy. Of course, they were thrilled. People that have known Berta, who knew Berta her whole life, their whole lives were, you know, crying because they were, of course, to hear that these people are found guilty is significant. They also know that it's just, like I said, it's just they have to keep pushing and they have to make sure that these people actually stay in jail and that more people are prosecuted.
It's an ongoing process. We will leave it there. We were joined from Honduras by Jackie McVicker. Jackie is a member of the Atlantic Region Solidarity Network, working in solidarity with people struggling for social justice and environmental protection in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Atlantic Canada. And she's a former co-coordinator of the Maritimes Guatemala Breaking the Silence Solidarity Network. We thank her for joining us. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back in a minute.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Manor Care was a highly respected nursing home and retirement community company based in Silver Spring, Maryland. 5 years ago, it was taken over by the Carlyle Group, one of the largest private equity firms in the world. Under Carlyle's ownership, however, the company went bankrupt and serious cases of elder abuse are now coming to light. We're joined from Philadelphia by Len Haberman. He's an attorney with the Senior Justice Law Firm who has specialized in elder care and nursing home abuse cases for more than 20 years. Len, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Len, there was a piece in the Washington Post today that was just alarming. It talks about horrific abuse that elderly people have had to suffer through, especially at a Manor Care facility in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. Talk about some of that abuse that you've seen and talk about this case. Is this typical of nursing homes in America today or is this an outlier?
It's 400% typical. It's not an outlier. And it's a shanda. In my family, that's Yiddish for a shame. I don't know the specifics of what happened at Manor Care in Pottsville. Do I represent clients against other Manor Care facilities? Yes. Have I seen the same type of mistreatment in other facilities? Yes, all the time, every day, all week, every month, the entire year, for years. But it's all about money. It's all about staffing. And it's all about the number of beds. A nursing home can only make so much money because it only has a certain number of beds in the nursing home. Therefore, to make more money, you must provide less staff, less services, less overhead in order to maximize profits. When a nursing home, not necessarily Manor Care, I'm not singling them out by any stretch, but when a nursing home, in my experience, wants to maximize profits, they will look to significantly reduce overhead. And the problem here, you know, when you reduce overhead at Best Buy, that means that the TV you buy, you know, you don't get as much help and you might buy the wrong TV that doesn't have the best picture. When you reduce overhead and you have less services in a nursing home, people get sick, they get bed sores, they fall, they get brain bleeds, and they die. So lack of money, lack of overhead, lack of life. That is the unfortunate reality of what I see every day.
In fact, that is what this article is talking about as well. It says here, one man had been dosed with so many opioids that he had to be rushed to the hospital. During an unsupervised bus trip to a church, one staff member was escorting six patients who couldn't walk without help. None of them could walk. A resident flipped backwards on a wheelchair ramp and suffered a brain hemorrhage. When a nurse's aide who should have had a helper was trying to lift a paraplegic woman, the woman fell and fractured her hip with her head landing on the floor underneath her roommate's bed. And it's a laundry list of issues like this. One woman talks about going to visit her father, and he was sitting in a wheelchair with no pants and no underwear, covered in bed sores. Just the notion that this is a normal thing in a country that purports to be the richest country in the world with allegedly, but incorrectly, the best healthcare in the world. This is just simply unacceptable.
There's a terrible stigma that I've heard, and I've seen it oftentimes, where we don't respect our elderly enough. And I guess I equate it to teachers and police officers and even people who are in the military. People are not paid enough. And the reason why you have injuries like these in nursing homes, again, I'm not speaking of the Pottsville Manor Care case because I don't know anything about it personally other than what I read in the Washington Post article, but you're talking about a lack of training. And you're talking about a CNA, maybe, or a nurse's aide who is not trained. If you train people better and you pay them more money and you fire the bad apples and the bad eggs and the people who don't care, who are lazy, and you train up the ones that want to make a career out of it, you'll have people who care for your loved ones, your mother, your grandfather, and so forth. The worst part about it is that many of the nursing home patients have dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and therefore they can't fend for themselves, speak for themselves. They can't say, I'm thirsty, I'm getting dehydrated. They have to rely on a CNA watching what are called inputs and outputs, you know, fluids in, fluids out. And if there's no fluid coming out, you're going to get a urinary tract infection. And from that, you're going to get what's called sepsis, which is an infection that ravages the body. And then you have total organ failure, including the heart, and then you die. And then what happens is the family comes in and says, what happened to dear old mom? And the nursing home says, oh, she had a heart attack. Well, not really. She had a heart attack because of organ failure, because of sepsis, because of an infection, because you weren't changing diapers, and she got a urinary tract infection. And that's what I do for a living as an attorney who practices nursing home litigation in Florida, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, is that, you know, usually it's not until I review the medical records and send them out for expert review that we uncover the real culprit as to why somebody passed away in a nursing home. Because unfortunately, many of the nursing homes are not very forthright and honest with the family members when they come in and find out, you know, that their loved one had passed away.
How much does the wealth of the individual elderly person, how much does that play into the kind of care that the elderly populations receive in nursing homes?
It depends on who you ask. If you ask the nursing home industry, they'll tell you that there is no connection between the compensation they're receiving and the care that they're providing. If you ask a cynic, which would be myself, you would see, you know, here's what happens. And you know, I'll put the question back on you. You tell me. You know, a third of my clients call me and they'll say things like, well, mom was being treated and cared for just fine when we were paying cash, i.e. $12,000 a month. But then when her cash ran out and when we had to go on the Medicaid system, suddenly the nurses were nowhere to be found and mom got poor care and whatnot. And these are phone calls that I field all the time. These are stories I hear. Medicaid reimburses anywhere from, you know, $4,000 to $6,000 per month. So there's twice the incentive, by my cynical view, twice the amount of care to a cash-paying resident than there is to a resident who's on the Medicaid system. So if you're asking, does the amount that they're being paid have a direct relationship to the care that's being provided? Unfortunately, my opinion is yes.
Len, one of the points that this article in the Washington Post makes is that the executives at the Carlyle Group who were responsible for researching these issues and buying the company in the first place, buying Manor Care, knew nothing about the elder care industry. They knew nothing about nursing homes. They thought they saw an easy investment with a quick buck. And one of the nursing home administrators says that he continually tried to educate these Carlyle executives. Do you think that a part of the problem is this lack of understanding, or is this a deeper problem that's more prevalent across the elder care industry?
Look, obviously it doesn't help if the executives were unaware as to the inner workings of a nursing home and how to provide good patient care. You know, you'd like to think that nursing homes are owned somewhere along the line by medical people who know a thing or two about infection, sepsis, dehydration, malnourishment, UTIs, organ failure, bed sores. It's, you know, you would think that all the bad things that can happen in a nursing home, you know, would be known and would be preventable by owners of a nursing home who have been on the front line. So if you're asking me, if I, you know, if the world started tomorrow and I was building the first nursing home, I'm going to make sure that it's owned by a physician or a nursing group or a medical group, people who know the medicine. When you just have investors, I mean, talk about fluid in and fluid out, all they're concerned about is money in, money out. And again, I'm not talking about the Carlyle Group, because I personally do not know what they knew about the medicine. So my only point is that it would be nice if an owner of a nursing home or a group knew the medicine. It's not enough to say, well, we hire a nursing home administrator and we assume that the administrator knows the medicine. What if the administrator is a dum-dum? What if the administrator is lazy? What if the administrator is going through a divorce and has a mental crisis? What if the administrator is just a bad egg? Who knows?
We have 30 seconds left, Len Haberman. Should elder care be treated as one more commodity for sale, or should it not be for sale at all and be considered a human right that society makes sure that resources are allocated for, so that all of us as we get older can be guaranteed that we will have our final years in a place that's safe, that's comfortable, that's friendly? Should it be reorganized on that basis?
So all you have to do is go to Google and type in nursing home abuse, and or look at the things that happened in the Washington Post article, look at all the bad things that happen in nursing homes, and ask yourselves, do you want this for your mother? Do you want this for your father? Do you want this for yourself, your children? Do you want this for your grandparents? And if the answer is no, then you've answered your own question. As far as I'm concerned, when you get into your later years, and I know we're running out of time, you should be permitted to live out the rest of your years in dignity. Whether you have 10 years left or 10 days left or 10 hours left, you should be treated with class and dignity at the most vulnerable stage of your life. I think that's what we should be shooting for.
Amen. We'll leave it at that. We were joined from Philadelphia by Len Haberman. He's an attorney with the Senior Justice Law Firm who has specialized in elder law and nursing home abuse cases for more than 20 years. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The political news website Politico this week published an article about the foreign press and their apparent love affair with Donald Trump. The thrust of the article was that the foreign press doesn't criticize the president because fawning coverage is a way for countries to ingratiate themselves with him. But the article focuses on, of course, the Russians. It makes no mention of the Israeli press or news outlets in most Arab countries. We're joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me again, John.
Joe, what is it about these foreign media outlets? Many of them are government-controlled, government-owned, government-sponsored. You know, when I was in government, we would read statements or reports prepared by USIS, the United States Information Service, talking about the foreign press and what was covered that day. And it was only low-level analysts like me. Well, now these reports are going all the way up to the president, and he's actually making foreign policy based on them. What kind of impact does this have?
Well, I mean, the president of the United States making policy based on foreign media reports, is that what you're suggesting? He should be listening to his briefing at the CIA in the morning rather than that. But There's been, of course, over the last few years, a wave of countries that have English language broadcasts that never existed before. So they are having some kind of impact, perhaps, on the American people, although not very much because the audiences are so small, but it's causing alarm amongst people like Politico because the American corporate media is losing total dominance of the narrative. And I think that's what's upsetting people in the U.S., particularly writers like this in Politico. So it's obviously a great contribution to the discussion to have other countries' viewpoints. The idea that Trump is never criticized in other countries, I think, is questionable, to say the least.
It's untrue. I mean, here, I want to go through the headline of the story is the foreign media that dare not speak ill of Trump. Even countries angry at the U.S. avoid insulting the volatile president. So there's kind of two elements of the story. One is the media overseas isn't the real media because it has a political line, and the political line is such they don't want to antagonize a narcissistic president. But the untrue part of it, I mean, there may be an element of that because, of course, you know, if you're trying to have good relations with the United States or do something with the United States, maybe antagonizing Donald Trump isn't the best plan of action. But it's also untrue. Look at the last paragraph of this article. When the Kremlin-funded news outlet RT referred in September to Trump's policy in Syria, where Washington and Moscow have chafed, its headline did not lay the blame at the president's feet. Instead, it declared, "Deep state has full control." Okay, if anybody listens to or watches or goes to the RT website or to the Sputnik website, there's a whole variety of news and positions, and some are on the left, some are on the right. The idea that we are not critical of Donald Trump because of some dictate, that's not true. Anybody listens to this show or by any means necessary or almost all of the programming on Sputnik, not true. And in the case of RT, just go to RT's website today. It's not uncritical of Trump, nor has it ever been uncritical of Trump. Even when the Russian government was undoubtedly hoping that there would be a president in the United States who was more for a good relationship with Russia, and Trump said he wanted it, which would make some people, and Putin said he was preferring Trump over Hillary Clinton in the election. Even with that, these news outlets, frankly, did not curtail or stop anti-Trump news stories from coming out. It's just not true.
We could spend the rest of the interview dumping on Trump if you'd like to prove the point.
Indeed.
You could just attack everything, every bit of his policies, except his once desire to have good relations with Russia and perhaps to solve the nuclear crisis in the Korean Peninsula. But I'm speaking for myself, just about every other policy he has, from climate change to taxes to his ideas on health insurance to torture, are abominable. Immigration could throw in there. And I think you've had programs, especially on immigration and all those issues, that made very clear that Trump is a disaster. So this is just cherry picking of the worst kind. They've just taken one story out of so many that they can have taken, that the deep state has full control, to try to make a larger point, which is completely ridiculous, that Russian language or English language Russian media has some love affair with Donald Trump. It just, the evidence doesn't bear that out.
One of the points in the article regarding China's media, the political article says, in July, for instance, the Hong Kong-based South China Morning Post reported that officials in Beijing had ordered state media outlets to soften personal criticism of Trump to avoid antagonizing him and exacerbating tensions with the United States over trade. The message is not to antagonize Trump personally, but to keep the affair in the realm of state policy, close quote, one expert in Chinese foreign policy told the paper. You know, that seems plausible.
Sure.
Is that the same thing as the suppression of the news? And I just have to say, I've been invited to be on Chinese TV, CGTN, the national TV, about U.S. policy on Korea and on trade. I've been critical of Donald Trump, and that's happened since July. So again, is it just maybe this unnamed source? Perhaps it sounds plausible. It doesn't quite line up with the headline, though, that they dare not speak ill of Donald Trump.
At all. And in fact, even in the political article,
the example that they start the article with is the Crown Prince of Dubai flagging to a Republican lobbyist an article in Al Jazeera that was critical of Donald Trump and saying, you see, Al Jazeera criticizes Trump. We don't. We love Trump. I mean, it's apples and oranges here.
The article says Al Jazeera is the one exception.
Right.
From the other media. But here too, Joe, the story focuses on the state-owned media in China, Turkey, North Korea, and Russia. Well, what countries are not mentioned here? Well, let's think Saudi Arabia, for instance, or Israel, for instance. I mean, why aren't they included in terms of a media orientation that's, quote, pro-Trump?
Well, Saudi Arabia, these are allies, of course, of the U.S. That's a very good point. They're attacking what is perceived to be enemies or adversaries of the U.S. They're the ones with the bad media. Look, every country, when it comes to their own domestic affairs, they're going to most likely protect their own interests. That's an unfortunate fact of the media and the corporate U.S. media, so-called private media, non-governmental media that's supposed to be the free one, is just as bad as anyone else. But when it comes to foreign leaders, does it determined by the particular policies of the day and the relationship that those countries are having with the U.S., it could be. I mean, everybody who's worked in journalism knows that you get frustrated by editorial decisions, and sometimes you don't really understand why. And it happened with me at big newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, where I wrote where stories were killed because they did not fit into the U.S. Policy, the U.S. agenda that a big newspaper like the Journal pushes, rather than objectively looking at the international arena. And this is an unfortunate fact of journalism everywhere. But to single out foreign media like this, ones that are not allies of the U.S., like you just mentioned, Saudi Arabia and Israel, as being somehow, you know, kissing Trump's behind, is just, it's ludicrous, really. I mean, yes, you can find examples wherever you want to make that point. As I was saying before, cherry picking some examples. And this is what this story does. And it's kind of really doesn't really advance our understanding of foreign media very much, in my opinion.
Joe Loria, let's change subjects because we have you only for another 2 minutes in this segment. I was looking at Consortium News, your website, about the Assange hearing yesterday. What's the latest there?
Well, there'll be a delay of several days until the judge calls back the parties. That would be this reporters committee that has filed a motion to get the whatever it is, a criminal complaint or indictment unsealed. And the government, of course, argued that they'd made a mistake in having this inadvertently being published, that it even exists. But they are arguing that it cannot be revealed because there hasn't been an arrest yet. Now, in normal cases, that's totally legitimate for the government not to want to alert a suspect that the cops are coming because he could harm the arresters or he could flee or destroy evidence. But in the case of Julian Assange, it's absurd that he would try to flee. He's purposely not fleeing the embassy because he knows he'd be arrested. But I fear that the judge will decide in the government's favor, if not only not to set some kind of precedent, and that we won't see the indictment or criminal complaint, whatever it is.
Yeah, I want to talk about the judge for a minute. And I apologize that we have so little time left, but this is Leonie Brinkema we're talking about. She's a former prosecutor, a former assistant U.S. attorney. She's a Ronald Reagan appointee to the federal bench, and she's a hanging judge. She reserves all of these national security cases for herself. And I know I'm sounding like a broken record, but there's something to this. She handled my case, Jeffrey Sterling's case. She has Ed Snowden's case. And now it's clear that she has Julian Assange's case. Nothing good can come of this if Julian somehow finds himself in the Eastern District of Virginia. It's already set up. It's already predetermined. This is not justice.
Well, I hope she's as lenient to Julian Assange if he ever winds up in her court as he was to this man who was convicted of domestic abuse. She let him off for time served. I really think that she's a tough judge. She's very involved in her cases. She runs a tight courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not the place anyone want to be if you're innocent. But, you know, I think she seemed fair yesterday, but I don't expect her to rule in the favor of the motion to unseal this indictment or criminal complaint against Julian Assange.
That was the voice of Joe Loria, who joined us from Virginia. Joe is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's also the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back in a minute.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, and funniest headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Brian.
Delighted to join you.
Steve, yeah, we always have so much to talk about in this segment. We never have enough time to do it, but there is so much egregiously wrong, inappropriate news out there this week that I'm not even sure where to start. I think you wanted to start in Ukraine. Is that right?
I did. And this is an article I found in the Google News fact check column. And the headline, which sounds sort of normal for a fact check column, says video fact check. 8 Putin claims regarding the Kerch Strait incident. That's the incident where Russia seized 3 Ukrainian naval warships. And what's interesting about this article is the source, which was polygraph.info. So I click on the link. And if you go to polygraph.info, there's just this fact check article, and you wouldn't know anything else unless you click on the About link on that page and find out exactly what Polygraph Info is. And here's what it reads. Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website produced by Voice of America and Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty. In other words, it's the U.S. government.
And not only that, it's the U.S. government's propaganda arm.
Exactly. So it was bad enough when Google and Facebook enlisted the Weekly Standard, a right-wing source, as one of their handful of approved fact-checkers, and now they have the U.S. government as a fact checker. I mean, it's really absolutely outrageous. I use that word a lot, but this really deserves it.
Before we get into the details of this, can you tell me more about this Google News fact checker? I use DuckDuckGo now based on Chris Garafa, our Monday Technology Rules regular segment recommendation. So I don't even use Google News. So Google is now fact checking news? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, Google News is a news.google.com is a website which, you know, summarizes the headlines of the day in various categories, which is one of the things I look at quite regularly. I'm sure a lot of people do. And the left-hand two-thirds of the page are the news articles, the little summaries of the different news articles. But down the right-hand column, there is a fact-check column, which picks 5 or 6 articles from the last few days or whatever it is and does fact-checking on them. And they have Snopes and others, and PolitiFact, I guess it's called. And now they have polygraph.info.
And now they have VOA doing this too.
Yeah, it's outrageous. And if you read the particular fact checks, you can get an idea of what this means. Basically, it's like going to a State Department press conference. Like, it starts out, Putin said, he talks about that the Black Sea, the Kerch Strait incident was a provocation. And their fact check is, yes, it was a provocation, but it was a Russian provocation, not a Ukrainian one. Well, I would call that a judgment call. It's certainly not a fact of who exactly was the provoker, et cetera.
Right. I mean, Ukraine was the one to sail into the strait without, you know, letting anyone know, and the ones to take the covers off of the guns on their ships. That feels like a provocation, but...
Yeah. I mean, there's a case to be made either way, to be sure,
exactly.
But it's certainly not a fact that should be checked. Then they talk about... Putin talks about Crimea deciding to join Russia. And here's their fact check. The Crimea didn't, quote, decide to join Russia. The Russian military took the peninsula in unmarked uniforms, and part of the region, quote, voted, quote, under Russian occupation. So why did he put voted in quotes? There was a vote. There was an 83% voter turnout, and 97% of the people voted to join Russia. So, you know, if you didn't support that, you could have not voted, which 17% of the people did, or you could have voted no or cast an invalid vote. Though there was an overwhelming vote. They don't have to put voted in quotes. I mean, it's outrageous.
And 83% is like double a good year in America.
Here's another fact and fact check correction by the Voice of America, also known as Polygraph, used by Google. Quote, Putin, the hard events of a civil war in Ukraine and in Southeast Donetsk and Luhansk regions. End of quote. Here's the fact. There is no civil war in those regions, but rather a Russian invasion and occupation. Wow. I mean, that's just not a fact. I mean, there is a civil war. Thousands of people have died. There hasn't been a Russian invasion. There are pro-Russian forces who are fighting militarily there. You know, when we think back about the facts that the U.S. government has dished up to us over the years, John, just think if we had the internet back, say, summer 1964, when those North Korean small PT boats fired on a U.S. naval destroyer, thus precipitating...
Yeah, the Vietnam War.
The massive invasion of Vietnam. That would have been, you know, the North Vietnamese would have said at that time, no, we didn't do this. And then the U.S. government and organizations, propaganda arms like Voice of America, which existed at that time, would have put out a fact check, correction.
Right.
Yes, they did fire. And then, you know, guess what? 40,000 American deaths later, or 58,000 and a couple million Vietnamese deaths later. We all know, in fact, the fact about the Gulf of Tonkin was a lie.
The whole war was based on a lie. Boy, that sounds like an ongoing theme through our recent history, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. I mean, I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, where there's an entire monument lined with Confederate generals. And we were taught in school that these were people who were heroes, who were, you know, to be honored. There are dozens of schools that are the generals, or they're the Jackson Lees or whatever, right? There's all sorts of Civil War Confederate generals who are honored in Richmond and in many places across the South. And those are facts, right? Except that they're not. Those are total judgments. And they're, you know, by our values today, not judgments that are correct.
I don't want to get too far afield, but you're exactly right, Nicole. It wasn't until I was 18 years old and I moved to Washington that I realized that not everyone is taught in school that Robert E. Lee was a traitor.
That's right. Yeah, we had a 2-year argument in the city of Richmond when I was, it was early 2000s, I think, about putting up an Arthur Ashe statue on the Confederate General Monument Avenue. Yeah, I mean, that was in the 2000s.
Oh, I remember that debate.
Let's go to another story.
I want to talk about a story that you've actually covered in several segments this week, but I want to talk about the media aspect of that story, and that's the story that was in The Guardian. And the original headline for this story read as follows: Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy. And very shortly after that story came out, both WikiLeaks and Paul Manafort issued tweets, I guess it was, saying this was totally false. And then an hour later, The Guardian changed their headline, and it read, Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy, comma, sources say.
I'm glad you raised this article, because you know what? We need to have a tutorial for all people. How do you read a newspaper, and how do you read headlines? Because while we make fun of this stuff, because most people form their judgments based on a headline, it's very important to read the headline carefully. And that's what Steve is helping us do. We're not just poking fun at them. But then even with that second headline, Steve, unless you're really, really paying attention, you won't catch the nuanced difference there either. So the first headline was, Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy. That seems declarative, categorical. It happened. It's a fact. The next headline, Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy, comma, sources say. Most people won't pick up on the sources say. In a way, it's kind of a headline trick, because they knew by then, when they made the second issuance of the story, that there was a lot of problems with the credibility of the basic fact of the story. And so in order to cover it, they put at the very end of the headline, comma, sources say.
And in the main body of the article, which is what they should have done in the headline, they added in more kind of softer language, because we don't actually have any proof of this, right? And we have actual more evidence that it didn't happen. They added more, it's unclear why Manafort would have wanted to see Assange, the last apparent meeting, you know, those softeners.
Added words, apparent meeting before, and they weren't there before.
In the original version. And I think the headline should actually have read, Manafort may have held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy, sources say.
Or the second headline, Steve, before you jump in, it could have been like, critics denounce false story of Manafort meeting with Assange that we just ran as a declarative statement of truth.
One small point about this headline, which I think is worth making, this bit where they call it secret talks. I mean, every talk with Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy is secret. There aren't press covering his private meetings with people. So, of course, it's secret. The fact that they put secret in there, which makes it sound, you know, ominous.
It sounds ominous, but when you have secret talks that don't actually happen, it's even stranger. They didn't happen, but they were secret.
Right, but here's my tech tip for the day for your users who listeners who manage websites, which is I'm sure a lot of people. And this is something, although I've been managing websites for 20 years, I only learned this recently. This headline, the original headline, when you post this article, even though they've changed the headline, both Facebook and Twitter cache their stories. So if you post this article on Facebook or Twitter, the original headline is what appears in the thumbnail, not the revised headline, as namby-pamby as the revised headline is, as Nicole just talked about. It turns out there is a way, if you manage a website, there are tools which you can use to change, to force Facebook and Twitter to reload the article so that it updates the headline for the thumbnail, which is very important because that's what most people see. And I'll put that information on my blog so that, again, anyone who manages a website should know about this because it's very important to be able to update your headlines if you made a mistake, say, in your headline, which you can do.
Steve, we only have now 30 seconds. You took your precious time to give a tech tip rather than the next headline. Let's do one last headline.
Yeah, let's talk about one of the most hilarious things of the week, and that's diabetes and diabetics not having enough insulin.
I don't think that's very funny at all.
Yeah, I'm a diabetic, but I have insulin, so thanks.
This is a headline from CNN. 40 million people with diabetes will be left without insulin by 2030, study predicts. And this is really one of these sins of omission headlines, because the headline leads you to believe, in the first three quarters of the article leads you to believe, it's just that there's going to be more people with diabetes, so we're in trouble because there's not enough insulin. But at the very end of the article, you learn the real story, which is that insulin isn't profitable enough for companies to be making it, and it's too expensive and people can't afford it. So the real facts of the story are buried in the very last paragraph of the article and certainly left out of the headline.
Yeah, there's nothing funny about this, John, but it is very, very misleading.
It's very misleading. It's all about the profits. But we're going to have to leave it there, Brian. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, that you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and you can go there to see all of the stories that we didn't have a chance to cover today. And we were joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. Nicole is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.